That's more or less the view of humanity. Well, this is it. I mean, this is it. And this is what is conveyed to your kids in the schools, all right? I mean, it's not said like that, but this is exactly what is taught. These are the values that are taught, all right? Now, no wonder that everybody has an inferiority complex, right? I mean, no wonder that everybody has a very weak, insecure image of what he is. I mean, who wouldn't have an insecure image if one is taught, if one accepts and one actually believes such a negative picture of oneself? Well, the Baha'i writings tell us that there's a third aspect, which is the capacities of the soul. In other words, there are three aspects to the human personality, not two. There is heredity, which is purely physical. Now, we can say that the heredity is also from God, but it's from God indirectly. In other words, what God does, he created, if you will, a machine that produces life. He created this process of evolution which produces life. So, in a certain sense, physically speaking, we are the result of a random process, but it's a random process that has been devised by God, all right? So ultimately, it is due to God, but indirectly. So even our heredity comes from God. I mean, everything comes from God. Even our heredity, physical heredity, comes from God, but it comes from God indirectly by this process. It comes immediately from our parents, and particularly from the particular sperm and the particular egg which have determined our heredity. And then we have the second thing, which is the soul's capacities. The soul's capacities. And then the third determinant of human nature is education, considered broadly as the sum of all interactions between this initial configuration of the environment. Now notice that the heredity of the individual is determined once a given sperm fertilizes a given egg. Because as soon as the sperm penetrates the egg, a hard shell forms over the surface of the egg, which prevents its penetration by another sperm. So once this act takes place, once this transaction takes place, the heredity of that individual is irreversibly determined. Now, this heredity determines that this individual will have certain capacities and certain limitations. Some of these capacities will be, and limitations will be, generic for the whole race. In other words, no human being can fly, for example. It is not the nature of human beings to fly. It is the nature of human beings to run, but some human beings will be able to run faster than other human beings. So some of the limitations and capacities will be generic. They will be characteristic of the race. Some will be individual. They will apply to some people and not to others. The same is true of the soul. At the moment the soul is created, that's what we just read, at the moment the soul is created according to this preordained measure of God, its capacities are eternally fixed. Nothing can add to them, nothing can subtract to them. Nothing can add to them, nothing can subtract from them. Now, this means that the soul has certain capacities and certain limitations. Again, it's exact analogy with physical heredity. An analogy, not an identity. Some of these capacities and limitations are generic, some are individual. Thus, all men have capacities. Well, let's read what Abdu'l-Bahá says about this. Let's read what he says about it. This is on page 193. It's from Some Answered Questions. Man has the innate character, the inherited character, and the acquired character, which is gained by education. So these are the three determinants of the human. With regard to the innate character, this is what I put number two. The innate character is the capacities of the soul. Although the divine creation is purely good, yet the varieties of natural qualities in man come from the difference of degree. All are excellent, but they are more or less so according to the degree. So all mankind possess intelligence and capacities, but the intelligence, the capacities, and the worthiness of men differ. Everybody is capable of thought, everybody is capable of feeling, everybody is capable of will, and so on. But then the proportion of these is different for every human being. And as I said earlier, there's many more things, I mean, that we can say about this. There is an attribute which is dominant in every person, Abdu'l-Bahá tells us, that God has caused one attribute of God, one capacity, to be dominant. So we can have fun trying to figure out what is our dominant capacity, if it's useful. And then he says, the variety of inherited qualities comes from strength and weakness of constitution. That is to say, when the two parents are weak, the children will be weak. If they're strong, the children will be robust. So, this is purely physical. If you look up the word constitution in the dictionary, you will see that it means physical, okay? So heredity is purely physical, and it is therefore temporary, because as we saw yesterday, everything physical is temporary. That's the nature of the physical world. Every material entity is this. So this heredity, once determined, is irreversible, but it's temporary. So the body is this temporary vehicle which comes into existence, which is joined with the soul, but which declines and eventually goes out of existence. So the potential that is created by heredity may or may not be fulfilled. In other words, if the needs, the physical needs of the person are not adequately met, then maybe the genetic potential that is there in the beginning will never be fulfilled. I mean, the very obvious example is, suppose the person dies as a child. I mean, then obviously his genetic potential will never be fulfilled. So he might have been a potential genius in something or whatever, but that will never be fulfilled. So we have no guarantee that this potential of the physical heredity will be fulfilled. However, we do have the guarantee that this spiritual potential will eventually be fulfilled, because that's the whole purpose of our life. And the process of fulfilling the spiritual potential is sufficiently complex that it will take all eternity, that we won't get bored with it during all eternity. Okay? So in other words, but Abdu'l-Bahá says, I mean, I don't have time to identify every quote, but he says, point blank, he says, God has an infinity of attributes. And remember that the human being has the capacity of reflecting all the attributes of God, and therefore we have a capacity of reflecting, to some degree, an infinity of attributes of God. And what is the limit to degree? Well, there's no limit to the degree. There are different degrees, but there's no limit to them. And so we can go on developing our capacity to reflect these attributes of God through all eternity. So this is the potential that is created by each soul. That is potential by, created by each soul. Now this is a value. We don't possess it, we are it. So let's say this. Our intrinsic value, because this is the key notion, our intrinsic value lies in what we are. Not in what we possess, or in how we are perceived by others. Now you see, there are similarities between the body and the soul, between the spiritual, the physical development that starts with heredity and the spiritual development. But there are also differences, and here's the difference. Remember we saw yesterday that the principle of existence in the material world was a composite principle. Now, so any physical entity is a system. It is a system. Your body is a system. Now, what does that mean, besides just being words? It means the following thing. A system is composed of parts. Some of the parts of a system can be alienated from the system without destroying the system. Okay? So, for example, if you lose a leg, you can lose a leg without dying. Right? So, you have altered the system if you lose your leg. You have lost the capacity of ambulation that was represented by that leg. So you have diminished your physical capacities. That's true. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the system still exists. The system has not been destroyed. So that is the nature of a composite system, that the system can be altered without being destroyed. Okay? The system can be altered without being destroyed. And that's part of God's design with the physical creation. However, we know that the soul and its capacities are, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, wholly outside of the physical world, and that the soul is not composed of elements. It is of one unified substance, like the essence of God, in that respect, like the essence of God. In other respects, not like the essence of God, not pre-existent, for example. But it is of one unified substance. Therefore, there are no parts to the soul. There are no components to the soul. And therefore, no part of the soul can be alienated from the soul. So you can't alienate your mind or your heart or your will from your soul. And you can't diminish these capacities of the soul. In fact, as we know, the soul is in its nature immortal. So this is an intrinsic value. This is what Abdu'l-Bahá says is the image of God within us. The image of God within us is the capacities of our souls. And this is what he means, it would seem, when he says that we must love the creatures for the sake of God and not for their own sake. In other words, we cannot love the creatures for the way we perceive them, but for what they really are, which is their capacities which come from God. How can you not love what comes from God? Remember that ultimately truth, beauty, and goodness are the same thing. The blessed beauty is one of the names of Baha'u'llah, the ancient beauty. So beauty and truth are really the same thing. There's no difference. Ultimately, there's no difference. So, to know the potential of a soul is to love that soul. You cannot not love it because that potential is from God. It is from God. How can you not love something that is from God? Now, of course, you can't love ugly actions and cruel actions, but those don't come from God. They come from us. As Baha'u'llah says in the Gleanings, every evil thing is from yourselves and every good thing is from God, right? So we can't love the creatures for themselves, for what they do with this potential, how they misuse it, but we can love the potential because that is supremely beautiful. It comes from God. So this intrinsic value is the only real value we have, because we've already seen that we don't possess anything, that possession is an illusion. So, the only value we have is this. But that's pretty good, because that comes from God. That means that what you are, all of your capacities and your limitations, come from God, and they're part of God's purpose. And they make of you a unique human being. You see, some people say, well, isn't it unjust that there are innate differences between human beings, that some people are more intelligent than others, let's say. Suppose that the world was made of 5 billion copies of you. Then you would be perfectly useless to the world. Right? If the world was 5 billion copies of you, then we could kill you and nobody would know it. Because there's 4,999,000 and so on other copies of you left, right? So the fact that there is individuality, the fact that each human soul, how many human souls are there? Abdu'l-Bahá tells us in the Tablet of the Universe, an infinity. Not a big finite number, an infinity of human souls. And every one of them is unique. Every one of them is unique. It represents a slightly or greatly different spectrum of divine capacities. So rather than seeing this as an injustice, we should be grateful. This is what makes us useful to the universe. This gives us a little place in the universe, something that we can be that nobody else can be. You are the only perfect you that exists. There's one thing that you can do that nobody else, even God himself, can't do, and that is be you. Right? You are the most perfect you that will ever exist in all the worlds of God. And therefore, and anybody else who tries to be you is bound to failure. If a person envies what you are and tries to imitate it and tries to appropriate it to himself, he is doomed to failure. He is doomed to frustration, because he can't. Because you are the only you that God has created. So this is the individuality. This is the intrinsic value, you see. Intrinsic is important. It doesn't come from outside. Since it doesn't come from outside, nothing outside can alter this value. Now we can begin to see the illusion of, say, materialism, of amassing material things. Why do people amass material things? Because they have the illusion that they are augmenting their self by possessing more material things. In other words, the businessman looks in the mirror in the morning, he doesn't say, I am the slightly balding, paunchy, man with bad breath who is unfaithful to his wife and is irritable with his kids. He says, I am the successful businessman who owns a car and a big house and has the respect of everybody and so on and so on. And he therefore thinks that in some sense he is a different person, but he's not, because his only value is what he is. Not how he's perceived by other people or how he perceives himself. That again is the vain imagining. You're talking about vain imaginings, that's it. It is the illusion that we add to ourselves, or we can add to what we are by possessing. And therefore we set out to possess. And how do you possess? By pursuing power. Because the more power you have, the more ability you have to compel other people to give you what you want. So there it is. The pursuit of power has its roots in the sense of valuelessness, the sense that we have no value and that we must seek our value. The pursuit of power is the pursuit of self-worth. That's what it is. The pursuit of power is a disguised pursuit of self-worth. And no wonder that we pursue power in order to have self-worth, because, as we said yesterday, it's intolerable for anybody to think of himself as worthless. I mean, this is spiritual suicide, right? It's psychological suicide to say, I have no value whatsoever. So this sense of worthlessness is intolerable, and therefore we must acquire worth. Or we pursue power through competition with others. We demonstrate that we have special abilities, as I said yesterday, special competence, and therefore that we have value. But everybody has some special competence. So it again is only others, the perception of other people, that determines that such and such a special competence gives a special value. In other words, ask the Africans if they think that a hockey player is a very special person, and they will probably tell you, well, I don't know, you know, I mean, can he run fast, can he hunt, you know, can he do it? No, but he can knock this little thing in the net, you know, it's really good. So, I mean, clearly we're dealing with cultural relativity here. So, it is the awareness of intrinsic value. In order to renounce the pursuit of power, we must know, not believe, but know that we have this intrinsic value. We must become aware of it. This is the knowledge of self that Baha'u'llah says is equivalent to the knowledge of God. Remember? He says that knowledge of the self is equivalent to the knowledge of God. The true knowledge of self is equivalent to the knowledge of God. When we know that we have this intrinsic value, is to know that what we are comes from God, and that this is the only value we have, but it's plenty. So once we really realize this, we don't need anything from other people. We know that the approval of other people cannot add to what we are, and their disapproval cannot subtract from what we are. Because our soul is not a composite. Nothing can be alienated from our soul. Our soul is not a system, it is an entity. So, to sum up then, I am suggesting that the key to the renunciation of the pursuit of power lies in true knowledge of the self, namely the recognition of intrinsic value, the recognition of the intrinsic value of ourselves, which implies that we recognize the intrinsic value of other people. Just a minute, I want to complete. You see, now here we get into something which is very, very important. How did we get into this notion? How did we get into this notion that in order to have value, we must have some special competency? Well, I feel that we got into this notion by uncritically transferring reasoning about material values to spiritual values. Now, let me say a word about this. What is the basic principle of economics? Go into any economics course in the world, Economics 101, go into it, listen to the first lecture. Everybody will say, the first principle of economics is rarity, right? That competition for rarity, right? That which is rare is dear. The rarer, the dearer. So the basis of material values is that that which is most valuable is that which is most unique, most rare. Okay? And this is the whole basis of economics, right? This is the whole basis. I mean, all of economic theory follows from this. Competition for rarity. Okay? Now, this is true. And why is it true? It is true because a material thing is diminished when it is shared. If I have an apple and I share it with you, then we each have half an apple, right? And if I share it with 10 people, then we each have 1/10 of an apple. So a material thing is diminished by being shared. And that is why the rarer a material thing is, the more valuable it is, because the less of it there is to go around. The harder it is to share it because there's less of it to go around. And therefore, it becomes more valuable for everybody. And therefore, there is competition to possess or control this rare thing. However, with spiritual values, it's exactly the opposite. The spiritual, the most valuable things spiritually are those which are the most universal, not the most rare. What is the most valuable thing? We just spent 2 days talking about the most valuable thing. The most valuable thing is love. And that's what Abdu'l-Bahá said, and we've read it twice, right? Love is the most valuable thing, and it is also the most universal thing. Okay? Now, how is love the most universal thing? Because an increase in love is a positive value under all circumstances. There is no conceivable circumstances in which an increase in love is detrimental. Now, it is also a value, for example, that we should eat good and nourishing food. But that's not a universal value. Why? Because it's not true under all circumstances. If, for example, to use Abdu'l-Bahá's example, if I am ill in such a way that my system cannot tolerate normally nourishing food, then it could even be detrimental for me to take in nourishing food. So I can't say that it is a universal value that I should always eat good and nourishing food. There are times when it's even better not to eat anything at all. We have a fast in the Baha'i Faith and so on. So there are relative values and there are absolute values. There are local values and there are universal values. These are all values and they're all important, but we have to realize those which are local and limited and those which are universal. And Abdu'l-Bahá says to us that the most universal value of all, in fact, the only truly universal value is love. Because love, an increase in love, is positive under all circumstances. So, when we come to spiritual values then, the more universal, the more valuable. Why? Because a spiritual value is multiplied when it is shared, not diminished. If I have love and I share it with you, does that diminish the love? No. Love calls forth love. If I share love, then this creates more love. So a spiritual value like love is multiplied by being shared. If I have a good idea and I share it with you, then we both have a good idea. And if you share it with other people, then lots of people have a good idea. Does that diminish the good idea? No, that multiplies the good idea. So you see, material things are diminished by being shared. Spiritual things, spiritual values, are multiplied by being shared. So all through history, we have pursued power because we have unconsciously, uncritically transferred a principle which is true about the material world, namely that the most valuable things are the most rare things, and we must compete for them. And in order to compete successfully, you need power, and we seek power and so on, the whole thing, okay? The competitive struggle for existence, as Abdu'l-Bahá calls it, all right? Whereas in fact, There is a complete inversion of values when we come to the spiritual, because spiritual entities and values are multiplied when they are shared, not diminished, and therefore we pursue spiritual values by sharing them with others rather than hoarding them, so to speak, by cooperation rather than competition. So, in order then to change our mindset, we have to really realize this. In other words, it's one thing to talk about this on the intellectual level, but it has to come down to the gut level, where every time we make a decision, where every time we interact with another human being, we have at the forefront of the fact that what we're doing is pursuing universal spiritual values and not competing for material values. So you go to the bank, you do a transaction at the teller's window. So that's the material purpose of you going there, but the spiritual purpose is to see if there's some way that you can uplift this person. Okay, that's what Abdu'l Baha says, right? He says, a true Baha'i is one who uplifts in some manner every single human being with whom he comes in contact. That's what a Baha'i is. That's a simple definition of Baha'i. He says, we must uplift in some way every human being we encounter. That's teaching the faith. Okay? That's teaching the faith. Is seeking to uplift in some way. How do you uplift another human being? Well, encourage them. Praise them. Say, you know, I really appreciated your service. Thank you. You know, I've been in here several times and you do a really good job here at the bank. I mean, how many times has a teller heard that? How many times do you think a teller has heard that? Probably never, right? But they sure hear about it if they make a mistake, if they make a miscalculation, or it takes too long, or whatever, right? And of course they're trained, and we have a social norm that says you have to be polite, so they say, what would you like today, Mr. Hatcher, you know? What would you like today, you know? Let me serve you, and so on, you know? Because they're gonna lose their job if they don't do this. But it's up to us to cut through this hypocrisy and to relate authentically to the real person that is there. So we encourage them, we pray for them. Why not pray for them while you're doing your transaction? Okay? Well, if we did that, I bet pretty soon people would start asking, what is it about you that's different from other people, right? And we could tell them about the faith pretty naturally. We'd say, well, there's not much difference about me than other people, except that I happen to have become aware of intrinsic value. And therefore, I'm trying my best to relate authentically to people, and I have become aware of intrinsic value because I'm a Baha'i. You know. So, in other words, it is not teaching methods or techniques that produces results. It is the reality that produces results. It is what we are. That's the only value we have. If we are nothing, we have nothing. It's what we are. It's the reality. That's what produces results. Nothing else. So, this is the way that I suggest that we can renounce the pursuit of power by the recognition of intrinsic value first. In other words, knowledge is first. First, we have to know, be aware of this intrinsic value in ourselves and others. This cuts us free from competition, from the pursuit of power, from the need for others' approval, the fear of their disapproval, and so on. It cuts us free from that anxiety of saying, well, what does he really think of me? Or is he trying to manipulate me? So he's trying to manipulate you, so what? You know, if he's trying to manipulate me, then, you know, too bad for him. The poor guy is caught in one of these cycles that we all get caught in. It cuts us free from this, and it enables us to begin to relate authentically to other people. System called the world order, the covenant, which utterly defeats the pursuit of power. In the system of Baha'u'llah, it is absolutely impossible to be successful in pursuing power. That doesn't mean you can't try, but you cannot succeed. What it ultimately comes down to is the infallibility of the House of Justice. In other words, what is the guarantee that a sufficiently clever and sufficiently pathological individual could not subvert the whole Baha'i community by perniciously pursuing power in various devious ways over a period of time? You know, I mean, he could fool counselors and hands of the cause and everything else, but he can't fool God. Remember, Muhammad put it very well, they plotted and God plotted, and verily God is the best of plotters, okay? So, you see, it all comes down to the infallibility of the House of Justice. That is our only guarantee that our future will be different from our past. It is the only guarantee that our collective future will be different from our past, that the pursuit of power will be totally defeated in society, collectively, not just from individuals who will benefit from their pursuit of power, just as Christian saints have relinquished the pursuit of power and benefited spiritually from this down through the ages. But collectively, this has never been done. It is the fact that the House of Justice is infallible, and they can therefore infallibly detect and defeat anybody who is going to persist in the pursuit of power. So, I mean, obviously, if a person is persisting in the pursuit of power, there are going to be signs, there are going to be indications, it's going to be on the local level, he's going to, you know, local community, but somebody said, maybe this is just a conflict of personality between these two people, they're in competition with each other, and then it goes to other levels and so on and so on. And so, you know, so eventually he will learn the lesson, or he won't, but eventually it will be the House of Justice if this person pursues, persists in pursuing power to a point, he will simply be declared a covenant breaker. He will be either naturally eliminated, he will have a test which will force him out of the faith or whatever, or he'll simply lose interest in the faith when he sees that he can't accomplish his ends or whatever. Or else, if he persists in staying in the faith and pursuing power instead of pursuing authenticity, he will simply be declared a covenant breaker. And God will declare him a covenant breaker because the House of Justice is infallible. So I want to close by stressing that in a very real sense, the Baha'i faith is the infallibility of the House of Justice. It's not just that we accept the verdict of the House of Justice for the sake of unity. They are infallible. Their decision is the decision of God. You know, there was a case, for example, some of you may have heard of this, where a group of people in South America were taught the faith by covenant breakers. And then when they realized this, they realized that they'd been taught the faith by covenant breakers, they said, well, but we want to be Baha'is. I mean, we understand now what it is, a covenant breaker and so on, but we want to be Baha'is. So the House of Justice sent Hand of the Cause, Dr. Furatan, to meet with these people and sort of assess their spiritual condition and report back to the House of Justice. So he questioned each one of them, and he He reported back to the House of Justice a list of names that he said, I have verified, in my opinion, all of these people are sincere in their desire to be Baha'is. They understand, you know, what they have been mistaught and so on. And the House of Justice accepted all the names but one. And they said, go back and talk to this other person. And so Furutan went back a second time and talked to this person alone. And he reported back, in my opinion, this person is utterly sincere. And the House of Justice says, go back and talk to him again. And they went back and talked to him again. And the guy finally said, I'm totally faking. He said, I wanted to test the House of Justice to see if they could find an insincere person. I have no interest in being a Baha'i. I think the whole thing is a fairy story. But I was just interested to see if I could pull one over on the House of Justice. And so for the House of Justice, this was just a list of names. I had no personal knowledge of any of these people. Okay? I mean, that's just one instance. That sort of thing happens 20 times a day in the House of Justice. Okay? I mean, the House of Justice is infallible. And the infallibility of the House of Justice is the bulwark between us and the injustices of history. So this is why the Baha'i faith is perfect and complete, because it gives the answer both on the individual level in the form of this clear understanding of the nature of the human being, and on the collective level in the form of the covenant. So that's all I have to say.
But there's a difference between, in fact, the writings say very clearly there's a difference between a philosopher and a prophet, in that the prophets also do what they say. In philosophy, we can have lots of ideas.
Talk about it.
Right. We can talk about it. We can generate many volumes of work. And I think what I was thinking about, I wrote down here that to me, Bill actually combines intelligent, disciplined scholarship and heartfelt spirituality. And I think this is a rare combination. And I know both him and Judith have suffered a great deal of difficulties and sacrifices in Russia. And in many other places, to be quite honest, more than 20 years of service of the National Assembly. And that service I regard as family service, because knowing what it means to be away from the family and how much weight that puts on the wife in the family, or the husband, depending on which one is given up, takes a great deal of sacrifice. And I think that the difference between the kind of scholarship that is offered to us in these last 2 days is that this family actually lives what they're telling you. So we thank you very much for being here, and we're going to give you this little gift of the Kitabi Akdas by Habib Rizaki.
Well, you've already given me much, so you don't need any more.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you. All right.